legend becomes fact. Print the legend.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Trusting in the sanity and restraint of the United States is not a strategy, and it is not an option.
We don't need no thought control.
What's a conspiracy notion out there? How much influence do you have? Was it you and your fellow neoconservatives that created the momentum towards overthrowing Saddam Hussein?
Nobody does a thing in this town without our approval.
You both were members of Skull and Bones, a secret society at Yale. What does that tell us?
Not much, because it's a secret.
Is there a secret handshake? Is there a secret code?
I wish there were something secret I could manifest.
322, a secret number?
There are all kinds of secrets.
Welcome back to Cloak and Dagger. I'm your host, Lenny Bloom, along with my co-host, the great American Judge Buster Sherman H. Skolnick, and we're here to celebrate Guy Fawkes Day. Remember, the 5th of November, and of course, we're here to expose the state secrets, the shadow government, the ruling elite, hope you don't learn. And for this special occasion, this special 400th anniversary, we are joined by one of the great experts in history and one of the top historians worldwide, the author of Synthetic Terror and the unauthorized biography of George Bush, none other than Webster, the illustrious Webster Tarpley. Webster, it's an honor to have you here with us today.
Thank you so much, Lenny. Happy Guy Fawkes Day.
Happy Guy Fawkes
Day.
We're
honored to have you, Webster. Happy Guy Fawkes Day to you too, Sherman.
Well, we're not going to make this this is a briefing, and we're going to, Sherman and I are going to hold our questions for when we get a moment to get them in there, but we expect you to dig in deep and early and then let us get our questions in after a period of time. So, Webster, go ahead and fill us in on what is Guy Fawkes Day that they've been celebrating and talking about for 400 years.
Yes, in England, Guy Fawkes Day still remains one of the biggest holidays of the year. If you've ever been there, they have bonfires. It's sometimes called Bonfire Day. They have huge effigies of Guy Fawkes, sometimes effigies of the Roman Pope that are dragged around the streets and burned. It used to be, up until the late 1950s, it was illegal not to celebrate this holiday. It was a compulsory holiday. And it was also enshrined, as we'll see, in the Anglican Book of Common Prayer. In other words, the state religion, of which the Queen is the head, had a special church service for November 5th that focused around gunpowder treason and the miraculous deliverance of King James V from this plot. Now, let me just sum up for people who are not so familiar with this in various parts of the world what is involved. On the morning of November 5th, the British Parliament, the English Parliament, was supposed to meet, and that would be the King, the Lords, and the House of Commons all meeting in the same building, the House of Lords, which is not today's House of Lords, but an older building. And on that morning, it was announced that an inspection party the night before, just after midnight on the morning of November 5th in the wee small hours, had discovered Guy Fawkes with a lantern, with a supply of matches and kindling, and also a significant supply of gunpowder in his pockets, had been preparing to set off about 30 big barrels of gunpowder that had supposedly been concealed in the basement of the House of Lords. And the plot was to blow up the King, the House of Lords, and the House of Commons, along with the top leaders of the Church of England and everybody else, including all different people, in the morning when this thing met. Now, according to the story, Guy Fawkes was discovered by a patrol that had been sent out by the government acting on a tip, which I'll tell you about. And Guy Fawkes was immediately taken prisoner. He was taken to the Tower of London. He was immediately put under very severe torture. Some of his Confederates were arrested immediately. They were taken to the Tower of London. They were tortured. Another group of the plotters allegedly went out towards the area where Shakespeare's home was, out in Stratford-on-Avon in Warwickshire, for those on this side of the Atlantic. And they tried to stir up a rebellion. This was actually a plan that they figured that when the king had been blown up, they'd be able to start a rebellion. And these people, of course, were cut down pretty much immediately, and a couple of the most important of the plotters, really more important than Guy Fawkes, a guy called Percy and a guy called Catesby, were cut down in the process and killed on the spot. Now, it turned out that all of these plotters were Catholics, and this was the big thing. The government was very, very interested in the fact that they were Catholics, and before too long, the government did everything it could to tie these Catholics to the Jesuit order, allegedly acting on orders from the Pope in Rome and the general of the Jesuit order to blow up the British Parliament and kill the king, kill the lords, kill the members of the House of Commons. They were all executed within a month or two, Guy Fawkes, Winter, a bunch of others, and the Jesuit Father Garnet, who was the Jesuit provincial leader of the province of England, was also picked up. He was tortured. He was put on trial. I had a show trial for him, and then he was also executed. And this became then the basis of the entire English government for approximately 200 years, from the late 1660s until the middle of the 19th century. This thing was in the Anglican prayer book. It became a kind of an article of the state religion. And, of course, it's legendary. It's just a pervasive thing. So this occurred on November 5th, 1605. So we now have the 400th anniversary of those events. Now, the finding that I would start with is that the entire official story is a complete lie from top to bottom. And this looks forward to events like the Gulf of Tonkin, like 9/11, carried out really by the same faction, because this is the Anglo-Venetian Whig faction, the Anglo-American financier faction that has dominated the world for the past several hundred years. This gunpowder plot was one of their birth pangs, you might say. Now, in our own age, we've got 9/11, which seems to be part of the death rattle of this same Anglo-American financier faction. But we can understand them, I think, a whole lot better if we look into the history of these events. And let me just say a couple of words about the situation of the time. The big question you had in England, among other things, was the religious question. And the religious question was that Henry VIII had decided to go Protestant. His son Edward had gone on with this, essentially forcing everybody to change their Catholic religion that they had held for many, many centuries, and doing this with police state methods. England in the early 1600s was a police state. It was probably the most pervasive police state anywhere in Europe, except perhaps for Venice, which was the other contender, where spies were absolutely everywhere. The fact was that a very large minority of the population, say 40-45%, some would even say half of the population, especially in the north, especially in the west, especially as you got away from London, had remained Catholic. A large part of the nobility was Catholic. Shakespeare was a Catholic. Shakespeare's patrons, the Earl of Southampton, all Catholics. There was a very, very large Catholic underground, and the government was determined to crush this, and they were using police state methods. Now, just in terms of the general situation of Europe, you had a fight going on between France and Spain that had been going on for a long time. You had, above all, I would point to the fact that you had the Venetians, which were the superpower of intelligence, and no discussion of secret intelligence operations in this period can be complete without looking at the Venetians. And what the Venetians were interested in in places like England was they wanted people to be at war with Spain. Just to look, you look where Venice was. Venice was sandwiched in between Milan, which was controlled by the Spanish, the Papal States in the south, and Austria in the north. And all of those were Catholic powers, and most of them were controlled by the Habsburgs. So what the Venetians were always trying to do was to run around Europe and get people involved in wars with Spain. There had been a traditional alliance, you might say, between Venice and England going back to the early 1500s and the War of the League of Cambrai. So the Venetians have intelligence operations in Britain, and they try to use them to keep England hostile to Spain and keep Britain, if possible, at war with Spain. And one of the ways you can do this is to play the religious card and have a Protestant, militant Protestant government in London that is going to be hostile to Spain and later on hostile to France. Now, this means that all of this mythology about good Queen Bess and the golden age of the Tudors, this is essentially a big lie that has to go out the window. And this is one of the most deep-seated forms of propaganda and prejudice in the English-speaking world. So this is what we've got to cut through in order to get to the...
What king was involved?
Well, we're talking about King James I. King James I, he had been the king of Scotland. He had come to the throne in 1603, and he was new on the job. And let me tell you, I'll tell you a couple of things about him. But before we talk about the kings and queens, we had Queen Elizabeth had been in power until 1603. And she had died, right? She had no children, never got married. So there was a big fight with the Venetians intervening to see who would get to be the king. And the Venetians were in favor of James VI of Scotland. So they brought him in and made him James I of England. The idea was that the Venetians wanted the English to be free of the Scots. Normally, whenever the English invaded France, the Scots would invade England. Venetians didn't want that. The Venetians wanted the English to be able to devote all of their attention to making war on Spain, because that was what Venice required in order to relieve the pressure coming from the Spanish in Milan. Now, the key to all of this stuff is the Cecil family. You can't understand any of this without knowing something about Lord William Cecil, the elder one, and Lord Robert Cecil, who is the younger one. Now, whether you had Elizabeth on the throne until 1603, or James, who was there from 1603 to 1625, a tremendous amount of the real power was in the hands of these Cecils. These people were pro-Venetian, and they were intelligence game masters. They were master manipulators. They were devious in a way that for most people is unbelievable even today. They make, you know, people like Lavrenti Beria or Himmler, or J. Edgar Hoover, they make these people look like rank amateurs. Let's look at the Cecil family for a second. The elder one, you have to bear with me now, because you know the English, every English nobleman is a moving target, because he has the name he starts with, he generally has another name in the middle of his life, and then if he reaches the top of his career, he has a third name in many cases. William Cecil is the elder one. He's basically around during the time of Elizabeth. He helps to bring Elizabeth in. And he becomes Lord Burghley. Lord Burghley. So William Cecil, Lord Burghley. If you know any Shakespeare, you know who this guy is. Remember, Shakespeare is a Catholic activist. He hates the Cecil family. And he goes to tremendous lengths, risking his own neck, to put propaganda attacks on the Cecil family into his plays. If you know Hamlet, remember Polonius, the guy who gets stabbed by Hamlet? That's William Cecil. That's Lord Burghley. And he's a lecturer, he's a windbag, but he's devious, he uses his family as an asset, loses his daughter, this kind of stuff.
Webster, they didn't discriminate against Shakespeare because they made him famous. You say he was a Catholic.
He did it. This was an underground operation. He had powerful Catholic backers that were too powerful for them to just get rid of. But he was Shakespeare was driven out of playwriting. I mean, he was driven off the stage around 1610. He was simply driven out of business by this Cecil intelligence establishment. So the older Cecil is William, and his basic maxim was, and he wrote it up, this is all documented, whenever the Catholics become too popular, The government has to fix some odious design on them, which would never fail to be believed by the generality of the common people. And then you can put the penal laws into execution. So their basic method is that of provocation. Now, the one that we're going to be concerned with more today is Robert Cecil, the younger one. He's the one who does the gunpowder plot. He is the mastermind of the gunpowder plot. He starts off as Robert Cecil. He becomes Viscount Cranborne in the middle of his career. And then when he really makes it to the top, thanks to the gunpowder plot, he becomes Lord Salisbury. Now, the Cecil block is a permanent feature of English politics, and it's there today. The Conservative Party is the Cecil block to a large extent. There was a Lord Salisbury who was Prime Minister in the late 19th century. These people are very much around Lord Balfour, right? Balfour Declaration. He's a Cecil. Francis Bacon, Cecil's cousin. He's also very important a little bit later than where we are now.
But clarify for the listeners and for me, the Cecils, they plotted against the Catholics to blame them falsely for the gunpowder plot?
Absolutely. That's the whole thing, is to set up a fake plot, stock it full of Catholic patsies, fanatics, dupes, and their own double agents, and then pin that on the Vatican, pin that on the Pope, pin it on the Jesuits, and use that to get decades of absolute hysteria. And, of course, allow them to cement their police state in the middle of a population that had really very little use for them. In other words, they were something of a foreign body. Again, the mythology on this stuff is miles deep, that England was this stout Protestant power with good Queen Bess. And it was this was a horrible nightmare of religious persecution. The Venetian ambassador at one point says to Robert Cecil, you know, I can understand that you've outlawed the Catholics, but do you have to persecute them so much? You persecute the Catholics more than any minority religion is persecuted anywhere in Europe, and that's approximately accurate. Now, Cecil had a reputation of being plentiful in plots. Another portrayal in Shakespeare, now we're talking about Robert Cecil, the younger Cecil. This is Richard III. In Shakespeare's Richard III, that is another figure of Robert Cecil. And, of course, Shakespeare always has plausible deniability. They go to him and they say, well, you're attacking Robert Cecil. And he says, no, I'm just writing Richard III. What does he say? Plots have I laid, inductions dangerous, by drunken prophecies, libels, and dreams. That's Shakespeare putting Robert Cecil on the stage. Now, the third figure in this group, we have Cecil the Elder, Cecil the Younger, prime ministers in effect, Sir Francis Walsingham. Now, this is a guy with a Venetian pedigree a mile long. He's the one that is absolutely linked to Venice. During the reign of Bloody Mary, who was a Catholic persecutor, we had her, too. Back in the 1550s, we had 5 years when the Catholics got back in power and killed the 200 or 300 people in their own reign of terror, because this was mutual to a significant degree. Sir Francis Walsingham was driven out of the country. Where did he go? He went to Padua, meaning Venice, where he became the president of the Foreign Student Society. Sir Francis Walsingham is the founder of the British Secret Intelligence Service, the MI6 today. So this goes from the 1570s and 1580s all the way down to the present time. This is another reminder why the British intelligence is the most powerful and the most formidable in the world, because they have centuries-old networks that other people can only dream of. Walsingham recruited John Dee, a famous kook, and also Christopher Marlowe, the playwright. And it looks like Christopher Marlowe was liquidated. He was murdered when he began to pull away from Walsingham. So Walsingham has got Venice written all over him. Now, under Elizabeth, the elder Cecil always had plots. We won't go into these plots, but the gunpowder plot was just one of a long, long series. The Ridolfi plot, the Babington plot, the Throckmorton plot. Throckmorton plot is the most important because it leads to the execution of Mary Queen of Scots and then the Spanish Armada. Now, there was a rebellion against the Cecils led by the Earl of Essex in 1601, but it failed, and he was executed. So at this point, you got the Cecils in power, and when James comes in, they have a couple of more plots, the Bane and the By. The pattern of these plots is always, you have a Jean Provocateur sent out by the Cecils. They gather up a bunch of patsies, get them involved in a conspiracy. The Cecils observe the conspiracy as it goes along. The Cecils then make sure that they can implicate key important people, the political enemies of the Cecils, in the plot. Then they discover the plot at the last minute and execute their political enemies. So this is the setting. Now, when James first came into power, he promised that he would give toleration to the Catholics because he did not have the beef with the Vatican that that Queen Elizabeth had had. But once he got into power, James decided that he was happier fining the Catholics and expropriating them to get money. So there was a tremendous backlash of hatred and resentment against James among the Catholics, but it was not enough to cause this entire thing. So what we have is a group of double agents, and then we'll just talk about a couple of them. Guy Fawkes is really not the most important. He's the one who has been demonized, but the important ones are two guys called Catesby and Winter, and they meet in the early months of 1604, and they begin discussing some kind of a plot to take revenge on James I. Now, you have to look at these people. Where did these guys come from, Catesby and Winter, the original nucleus of the plot? They had all been involved in the rebellion of the Earl of Essex. In other words, these people all could have been executed by the Cecils as a result of this attempted coup by Essex against them, which failed. So you have to look at these two guys as essentially being part of the Federal Witness Protection Program. These were stooges. These were people that the government could essentially chop their heads off anytime they wanted. They were fined and reserved to Her Majesty's use was the word used at the time. So you've got two police informants, essentially, meeting to create a plot. Now, what do they talk about? They talk about, first of all, renting a room in a basement across from the House of Lords and digging a tunnel. And they start trying to dig this tunnel. But it turns out they can't do it because they have to go through a wall. So they also have to get a guy called Sir Dudley Carleton to come in, who is later on one of Cecil's big diplomats, to help them rent this room. So it's like having Henry Kissinger come in and help you rent the room, the safe house that you're going to try to use to tunnel under the House of Lords. Eventually, they find that they can't tunnel, so what they simply do is go and rent the basement under the House of Lords. And they stock this up with what looks to be gunpowder. We're going to see in a minute that it's not. They eventually recruit some other plotters. They recruit a guy called Thomas Percy. Okay, Thomas Percy is one of the leading plotters. So we've got Catesby, we've got Winter, we've got Percy. Here's a story about Percy. One of the people at the time, in the autumn of 1605, is going home at 2 o'clock in the morning, and he meets Percy the plotter coming out of Cecil's house. Get it? One of the main plotters is reporting to Robert Cecil about what's going on. So he's a double agent. It looks also like this guy Catesby is a double agent. And we've got Sir Dudley Carleton, who has helped them, who is one of Cecil's main diplomats, helps them rent the first basement that they tried to tunnel from. Now, there are other people. We can't go into all of them, but you've got this group of ex-cons, in effect, in the Witness Protection Program. You've got double agents. You've also got a couple of fanatics. You've probably got Guy Fawkes as a fanatic, a dupe, a patsy in that sense. Now, a couple of weeks before November 5th, when the Parliament is supposed to meet, this Catholic nobleman, Lord Mounteagle, comes forward and he says to Percy, to Cecil, "I just got a letter that says I shouldn't go to the opening of Parliament because it might be dangerous." And he shows him the letter. This is called the famous Mounteagle letter. So Percy waits 4 or 5 days until he can meet the king. And Percy, Cecil shows it to the king and says, Your Majesty, I got this strange letter from Lord Mounteagle. What could it mean that we shouldn't go to the opening of Parliament? I really can't figure this out. And James says, Oh my God, they're going to blow up the Parliament. Now, it turns out that James I, when he was in Scotland, was very unpopular. There were numerous attempts to kill him. And one of the attempts to kill him was allegedly a gunpowder plot. They tried to blow up James and his father. So he's used to this. Now, what you have here, of course, is Cecil wrote the letter himself, whether with his own hand or through some agent. Right? He had agents who could duplicate handwriting. So he gets the letter sent to Mounteagle. Mounteagle delivers it back to Cecil. Cecil takes it to the king, and he lets the king think that the king is a genius, that he is the Solomon of England, that he's the only one who could figure out such a deep, dark mystery. All right, so then they wait a few more days, and they send somebody over, right, and then they discover that it's Guy Fawkes. So I have a collection of prints here, which are very interesting, and they all show the same thing. Guy Fawkes, with his lantern, is about to go into the basement of the House of Lords to prepare the last details of the gunpowder trains that he's going to use to blow up the House of Lords. And he is then set upon by this night watch of loyal servants to His Majesty the King. So if you think about 9/11 in terms of memes, in terms of the elements of the myth, you got to have the House of Lords, you've got to have Guy Fawkes. Guy Fawkes is carrying a lantern. The lantern is preserved in a museum, and then he's taken. And often there's a light coming down from the Holy Spirit or some magical agency, a light that cuts through the darkness and like a spotlight that gets onto Guy Fawkes to help these guys find who he is. And this theme, these memes, were repeated again and again and again in the prints of the time. Now, the problem is, then, these other guys, Catesby and Winter, run off towards Stratford-on-Avon, pretty much, and they get killed. So it looks like some of these people were liquidated. In other words, these were double agents working for Cecil, but Cecil doesn't hesitate to kill some of his own double agents. He gets rid of them so that they'll never testify. And instead, what goes on is you have the torture of Guy Fawkes. He's put on the rack. And then you have the torture of Winter. And if you look at the signature of Guy Fawkes, you can see his signature before he was tortured and his signature after he was tortured, and you can see what they did to this guy. The Thomas Winter confession is written in a different handwriting, and the official confession has the guy's name spelled wrong. So they didn't exactly do a perfect job, right? They're always...
Webster, I'm looking... While you're discussing the details, I'm looking at the story on Encyclopedia Britannica online. Now, that's a pro-British printing service that's been printing encyclopedias for many years. So your position is that Britannica most likely is lying about the whole business.
You'd have to look at what they say, but obviously it is very polarized, and the official British stuff. There's a book from the 1990s which defends pretty much the official version of the gunpowder plot by Cecil, the Cecil version, and it's written by a guy who works at the British Army Museum. So it's the British establishment continuing to defend its own story.
There's two other historic things that relate to this. Number one, most historic reports about Queen Elizabeth I state that the only reason she wasn't assassinated, where there were numerous plots against her, was that she had such a wonderful intelligence service.
That leaves out the fact that most of those plots were organized by Cecil himself, Cecil the Elder. It was the line on Cecil.
That was designed to put the suspicion somewhere else, right?
That was designed to prove to Elizabeth every day that without Burghley, she'd be lost, that she needed Cecil the Elder more than life itself, so she dare not dump him.
Look at this statement I'm going to read to you from Britannica. Tell me what you think about it. Quote, "The plot bitterly intensified Protestant suspicions of Catholics and led to the rigorous enforcement of the recusancy law."
Recusancy.
"Which fined those who refused to attend Anglican services." So in other words, they used this to persecute Catholics and force people to go to Protestant services. Is that the long and the short of it?
What it meant was that you could get decades and decades, you could get a century more of religious oppression and the pretext for a police state. Remember, in France at this time, under Henry IV, if you were a French Protestant, a Huguenot, you were tolerated because there was the Edict of Nantes in the 1590s that said Protestants have, you know, they have certain rights and they can't be just, you know, crushed. But in England, if you were a Catholic, you had no rights. You could be fined. You could be executed. If you even tried to leave the country, they'd confiscate your stuff. If you sent your kid to a Jesuit school in Belgium, which is what Shakespeare's father did, Shakespeare's father sent Shakespeare to a Jesuit college in Belgium. If that had become known, if that had been established by Cecil spies, Shakespeare's father could have been expropriated of every penny that he had, every farthing. So again,
by the way, the effort over the years to claim that Shakespeare didn't write most of the things with his name on it was written by Francis Bacon. Was that an effort to discredit Shakespeare?
What it simply reflects is the British hatred of Shakespeare because he is not what they say. He is not the guy who celebrates Queen Elizabeth. I'll give you an example. Queen Elizabeth died in 1603. Every poet who wanted to make progress at the court, make money, wrote a great praise of the Queen. From Shakespeare, zero. He absolutely will not take part in it. Now, just to finish up some of the details on this stuff, the show trials were run by this guy Coke. He was the Attorney General. He was the Ashcroft or the Gonzalez. He's a torturer. So what he does is he gets a confession. He gets a confession from Guy Fawkes that says, we plotters had a mass that was conducted by Father Garnett, but we never told Garnett about the details of our plot. So what Coke writes on the papers, and you can see these papers today in the public record office, Coke writes in Latin, hook usque, in other words, stop here and leave the rest out. In other words, when you make your public harangue at the trial, don't tell the part about we never told Father Garnett anything about any plot.
Can I add something about Chief Justice Coke?
Sure.
A lot of the law in the United States is based on his decisions, which are called the Coke reports. And when they want to reach way back to support something that they haven't got a good American precedent on, the U.S. Supreme Court occasionally over the last two centuries would refer to him, Coke reports, C-O-K-E.
And it's a travesty.
Let me see if I understand this. You're saying that he was a counter-plotter of some kind?
No, he was the Andrei Vyshinsky. Remember, Andrei Vyshinsky ran the Moscow show trials for Stalin?
Yeah, I see.
Coke is the guy who ran the show trials, first of all, of Fawkes and Winter. And then they were all executed, and then they have a second round of show trials for Garnett, and then they kill him. Now, it's worthwhile to note that the Vatican had been informed by some of these English Jesuits that a plot was in the works, and it was essentially Garnett writing to Rome to say, look, I'm trying to stop these guys, but I don't know what to do. So he gets a message back from Claudio Acquaviva, the head of the Jesuit order, the Jesuit general in Rome, who says, the Pope, and I join with it, I command you to stop any violent activity because this will get us nowhere. In other words, these people were not fools. They could see what would happen. Even if the plot had succeeded, there's very little way that the plotters ever could have taken over England. It would have been others.
In the last couple decades, a story came out supposedly in supporting the British view that Guy Fawkes indeed was part of a plot. They alleged that they belatedly, like, you know, almost 400 years later, found something. Do you know anything about that? In other words,
I'll tell you what was found. Here's what was found. The big question for many years was, what happened to this gunpowder? Where did the gunpowder go? 30 hogsheads, 30 big barrels. So what you find now is in the London Daily Telegraph, May 4th, 1978, they found in the Public Record Office a receipt of the War Office dated November 7th, 1605, 2 days after the discovery of the so-called plot. They found, first of all, that it was not gunpowder, but corn powder. Corn powder was an inferior version of gunpowder. It had bigger grains, didn't give you that much bang for the buck. It's a little bit like these, homemade fertilizer bombs, something more like that.
Or firecrackers or something, huh?
And says that, as the receipt says, corn powder decayed, meaning inert. It wouldn't go off. So Cecil had the brains. If he was going to have this stage-managed plot, he made sure that the props were not live gunpowder, but decayed corn powder. In other words, these patsies and dupes and double agents were rolling barrels of inert gunpowder, corn powder, that wouldn't go off into the basement because Cecil didn't really want to blow up.
You know what's interesting, Webster? In 1993, the FBI, using informants, told them that it's an inert powder that they wanted these characters to use, these Islamists, in the basement of one of the World Trade Centers. But they fooled them, and they put real gunpowder, and it caused quite a bit of black smoke. And several people were killed. It went up into the building, 1993. That's, you know, to me, it's sort of like a takeoff in some way about this gunpowder plot.
That is that exactly, Sherman. That's very good. What is so uncanny about the gunpowder plot is that the whole repertoire of things that you find in the stage-managed terrorism, the state-sponsored terrorism of our time, you see the whole repertoire of tricks is already there. In 1605, conducted by these Englishmen, who in their turn had been trained by the all-time experts and superpower, the Venetians. So we've got a bunch of Anglo-Venetian operatives running around. And let me just say, why do I say Venetian? First of all, let me say that back in the 1580s, when you had this Throckmorton plot, which led to the killing of Mary Stuart, Mary Queen of Scots, and therefore led to war with Spain and the Spanish Armada, that was carried out by a Venetian agent, Giordano Bruno. Giordano Bruno, the philosopher and playwright, quite a famous guy in his own right, was working for Venice, and he came over and became the secretary of the French ambassador in London and did underground operations to get this Throckmorton plot going. He worked closely with Walsingham, and so therefore there's a Venetian angle there that you can see. Venetians operating in London under Elizabeth. And then we've also got the famous playwright Ben Jonson, right? The guy, the main rival of Shakespeare, I think a rather unsavory character to be sure. A couple of days after the plot, Cecil gave Ben Jonson the task of getting in touch with a certain priest. This is very mysterious stuff, never explained. Cecil goes to Ben Jonson and says, I want you to contact a certain priest. So Jonson writes back to Cecil saying, yeah, I tried it. I took the most obvious course. I went to the chaplain of the Venetian ambassador, but we couldn't get the priest to come out of hiding. So it means somehow the Venetian ambassador is sitting in the middle of Robert Cecil's plotting. Therefore, it's an Anglo-Venetian plot, and this is not idle speculation. This can be documented. And the role of Ben Jonson in the whole thing is very, very strange, because he would have met some of these conspirators at various taverns frequented, and Shakespeare also.
What do you make of stories? I'm not saying that I accept them, I'm just repeating them, that currently Queen Elizabeth II is sort of a closet Catholic. Is there anything to that?
I don't know. I think she's a pagan. I think she worships power like the rest of them. Let me just say, the other very important piece of proof we have is a report of an intelligencer, one of Cecil's spies. This guy's name is Henry Wright. And in April 1604, a year and a half before the big event in November 1605, Henry Wright sends a report to Cecil saying, I have a sub-agent working for me. The sub-agent's name is Davies. He is engaged in working a Catholic treason plot, the goal of which is to incriminate priests. In other words, we've got a sting operation going, and we want to suck these priests in so we can execute them and get the publicity that we want. And he says, I can give you up to 60 priests. So the answer goes back from Cecil's office, we don't need 60, we need fewer, but they should be top-level Jesuits and top-level seminary priests. And then they say to Davies, well, what's the treason you're working? And Davies, like a good agent, like Salem in the 1993 case that Sherman just referred to, Davies writes back, I will not declare the treason until you give me a pardon. I need a written pardon for what I'm doing so that I'm covered. And this the pardon was then, it's official, the pardon was granted on the 25th of April, 1604. So here it is. Cecil is running the plot a year and a half before the thing comes to the surface.
The other interesting thing is, on your book, Synthetic Terrorism 911, inside the front cover, you refer to this gunpowder plot. In other words, 400 years later, they still have so-called rulers, or whatever you want to call George W. Bush, doing this provocateur trick of blaming high-level politics, whatever you want to call it, on somebody, some group that they want to demonize.
Absolutely.
In the case of 911, they want to demonize Islam. And so they said that 19 Muslims did it, and many believe that the Muslims were simply patsies.
Exactly.
On a parallel track, while there was a high-level plot that piggybacked onto three or more mock drills that very same morning of September 11th, 01. And I think your book goes into that. So in a way, your book is a latter-day explanation of how a plot can be fake.
Exactly. And this, I think the importance of this is the methods of this faction. We're talking about, again, the English-Venetian faction, which in our own day is the Anglo-American financier faction, the City of London, Wall Street, and Washington. The methods are largely the same methods, and you can see that by this example from four centuries ago. And again, if you look at somebody like Shakespeare, you'll see that he was opposed to all of this. For example, the play Othello would seem to be Othello as a figure for King James, who is torn between Iago, representing Cecil and Venice, on the one hand, and Cassio, the Florentine, representing actual Renaissance values. And you see the way Iago tricks Othello, he isolates him, he gets rid of Cassio, gets rid of Desdemona, he distorts everything, he tells stories about the handkerchief and all of this other stuff. That's one figure of it. Measure for Measure, Lord Angelo, right, the guy, the hypocrite who takes over the government and wants to enforce the morality laws, but he also demands that that women yield to him, right? Angelo is another figure of Robert Cecil. And then in...
How did Shakespeare in England get away with this?
He did it because it's all in a coded language. In other words, none of it is... He has plausible denial at every point, and up for a certain time he has backers. For a certain time, he's actually writing these plays for Elizabeth. He's writing them for James to try to influence them. And ultimately, he's writing it for James's son, Prince Henry, who unfortunately dies, and then he's driven out of business. So you can also see this. The Shakespeare play that is most dedicated to the gunpowder plot is Macbeth.
Yeah, right? I was going to say that.
The killing of a Scottish king. But there, see, the thing with Macbeth is what we have as Macbeth is the shortest of all Shakespeare's plays. It looks like important parts have been cut out. King Lear comes from the same period, and it also seems to be a similar kind of argument.
Webster, you have just supplied a key piece of legal history, and frankly, your interpretation of history would see to it that you could never be a law professor in America. They'd run you out, because too much of American law is common law based on England, on the what they call the Lord, the Chief Judge, Coke reports. And from what you said, I gathered, unless I misunderstand, that Lord Coke was a tremendous faker and whitewasher and cover up type. Am I right?
He was the Ashcroft and Gonzalez, because he was presiding over this torture, and the harangue that he made, the speech that he made at the trial, was full of lies. See, about 100 years ago, there was a fight about the historical interpretation of the gunpowder plot, and one of the main Oxford historians, Gardner, came forward saying, how can you say that all of these wonderful noblemen of England who signed as witnesses for the Confession of Fawkes and the Confession of Winter, how can you say that they would sign onto something that was full of lies? And the answer came back from one of the Jesuits at the time, because that is what they did at the trial. Because this guy Coke got up, and in his speech he made wild fabrications, distortions, omissions. It was basically the Kane-Hamilton Commission. And none of these noblemen who had been witnesses to the actual torture, allegedly, stood up and said, but wait a minute, read the rest of it, right? Read the part that Gerard was there, but you never told Gerard about the plot.
In the very period that you talk about, 1605, the Court of Star Chamber, an infamous creature, continued in operation up until 1642. And if you were to go to a big law school, a building like the University of Chicago Law School, you know what's interesting? They honor the judges of the Court of Star Chamber, which if you didn't testify to their liking, they had no Fifth Amendment, you know what I mean? They would chop your hand off. And there in the law school is a golden framed picture of Lord Jeffreys, the chief judge of the Court of Star Chamber, about the period that you're talking about.
Well, I think
so what I'm saying is there is a great defect in American law, and you just pointed it out, because they base too much of their background on what they call the Coke reports. Right. You know what I mean? If they want to reach back to some precedent in common law, they refer to that. And you just torpedoed. I like it.
Judge Jeffreys of the Bloody Assizes is a little bit later. I think by that time we're in the 1660s. It's the Rebellion of Monmouth, who's one of the sons of the king.
Well, claims that the Court of Star Chamber ended in 1642, believe it or don't believe it. But what I'm getting at is the Coke reports. I always was suspicious of it, and you sort of supplied the detail that more Americans should know about, hopefully those that are going to listen to this program, because we don't have iconoclasts to point out the harsh truth and realities of situations. You know what I mean? They go along with the common lie, the big lie. In other words, you don't wish to go along with what you feel is the big lie about the guy about the gunpowder plot, right?
Because what we're identifying here is a permanent weakness of the English-speaking culture everywhere. In other words, if you've had this fabrication, this orchestrated, manipulated, stage-managed stunt of the gunpowder plot, and you've had that made into a religion. That got into the Anglican Book of Common Prayer, and it says in there, and this was up until the 1859, 1860, every 5th of November the priest has got to preach on the gunpowder plot. You got to read the Act of Parliament. You've got to go through this whole prayer routine about gunpowder treason and Guy Fawkes and the rest of it. It becomes a civic religion. Now, when you look at 9/11, there's an attempt to make 9/11 into a civic religion, an ersatz religion, a fake religion, and force people to believe it.
But Webster, if you know, because you're a profound historian and you properly pronounce words in foreign languages, so evidently you know a lot about these foreign languages. Did any in the papacy from 1605 to whatever date you know about, did they ever try to roll back what you feel is the big lie? Did they try to educate people, inform people that this gunpowder plot was a fake, or did they leave it alone?
The entire English Catholic community repudiated the gunpowder plot. As a matter of fact, they even repudiated it before it happened. There was a woman called Fortescue who lived in a famous building in London, the Blackfriars Gatehouse. And that Blackfriars Gatehouse was a safe house for priests. Later it was bought and endowed by Shakespeare as a safe house for priests. But
hey, is that connected with Blackfriars Bridge?
Well, it's the same neighborhood. Blackfriars was the old Dominican monastery, right? Blackfriars, Whitefriars.
But what about my question?
Let me just get through this. The plotters tried to come to this safe house for priests and say, "Let us in here. We want to use this as a base of operations." And Ellen Fortescue said, "No, you guys are a bunch of lowlives, right? One of you is a bigamist, Percy. You know, you're not really Catholics. You're a bunch of sleazy adventurers. I don't trust you. I'm not letting you in." So later on also, after the plot, the whole English Catholic community said, "We weren't a part of it. We had nothing to do with it." Now, the problem was Pius V Borghese. This is a very doctrinaire, pedantic pope. He repudiated it in private correspondence, but the big problem with the papacy was they needed to come out with an encyclical letter saying gunpowder plot is a fraud, here's how it was done, we didn't do it, Cecil did it. And this, for various reasons, Pius V Borghese couldn't pull himself or didn't pull himself together to do this, and this was another betrayal of the English Catholics, and this is one of the things that Shakespeare was bitter about.
And the date here, once again, for people who are just trying to follow this now, what date do you feel that this all transpired on? What's the date?
Well, the big day of it all is November 5th, 1605.
Right.
400 years ago.
And of course, this is pretty well almost 30 years before the act of supremacy that separated the church.
No, this is many years after. The Act of Supremacy is way back with Henry VIII.
No, it's 15.
And Edward.
The Act of Supremacy, the Act of Submission, is in 1534.
There you go.
So this is 30 years before that, right? Webster, this is... Wait, Sherman, excuse me. Let me just get the dates here. So 1505 is the...
1605, Gunpowder Plot.
1605.
1605,
right. So
400
this,
years ago.
Right, so this is many, many years after. Now, so my question to you is this. Since the attempts to obtain a divorce through pressure on the papacy failed, Cromwell turned to Parliament using its powers to decide the issue. The result were these series of acts cutting back the papal power and influence in England. What, if any, actions other than legislative do you feel the papacy took that are not recorded? Were there actions they took that are not recorded in history against the Church of England, or were they all legislative in your view?
This is a very complicated question. Let me just say, when you go back to Henry VIII, which you've done, right, and the seizure of the monasteries, this was actually a massive robbery saying all the property of the holy orders and the, you know, the monks and the nuns, and this is all going to be robbed by Henry VIII to create a new nobility based on this, who would be bound to him, because if the Catholics came back, they would be expropriated. The guy that you've mentioned is Thomas Cromwell, and Thomas Cromwell is the guy who convinced Henry VIII to do the seizure of the church properties, right? That guy is a Venetian agent. Thomas Cromwell is somebody who had worked in Venetian touting houses, and he, of course, is he's a fairly close relative of Oliver Cromwell later on, Oliver Cromwell being the dictator, the military dictator of Britain, generally between about 1650 and 1660, right, the Lord Protector. You also have, in order just to keep the historical accounting, you have this Bloody Mary period. And the Bloody Mary period that I mentioned is in the 1550s. So here you have Queen Mary, daughter of Henry VIII, right, coming in and reimposing Catholicism. And in this case, the Venetian agent on the scene is a guy called Cardinal Pole. Cardinal Pole is from the Plantagenet family, the older royal house of England that had been kicked out 100 years before. But Cardinal Pole is a Plantagenet who had been groomed in Venice for many years by Gasparo Contarini. In the period that we've been talking about here on the Gunpowder Plot, Paolo Sarpi is the head of Venetian intelligence. If we go back 100 years to the early 1500s, Gasparo Contarini was the head of Venetian intelligence. And these are the master manipulators, the master game orchestrators in Europe. And nobody could come near them in their ability to manipulate. So what you always have is at key moments, what you've got to see is the constant thing is the Venetians don't care which side is which. They're always in there to cause religious strife and above all make sure that you get an anti-Spanish government out of the entire process.
But Webster, what about, is there a simple answer to my question? From that period, 1605 to now, has there been of record any papacy, any pope who wanted us to straighten out the historic record of the Gunpowder Plot that the Catholics were not involved?
Well, the popes have not done this themselves. I point to two people, two Jesuits, two leading Jesuits that people can read because these books are available. The first Jesuit is about 100 years ago. You have a guy called Father Gerard, G-E-R-A-R-D. And he was a good polemicist and wrote some well-documented stuff on the Gunpowder Plot. He got into a fight with this guy Gardner that I mentioned. So it's the Jesuits against Oxford, the two lines. So Father Gerard 100 years ago. Currently, the Dean of Skeptics of 9/11 is Francis Edwards, who's alive and well and living in London. He's a Jesuit, and he wrote a book about it in 1969.
Really?
He's written articles about it. He's written a study of all of those Elizabethan plots that I talked about. Then he's written the early Jacobean plots, the early reign of King James plots, the Maine and the Bye, as they're called. And Francis Edwards is working on a masterful sort of magnum opus study of the Gunpowder Plot, which is, I believe, not going to be available this year, but it'll be available sometime in the future. But if you want to read something about it, Francis Edwards, he's got some articles in the early 90s, but above all, his 1969 book on, I think he's got Guy Fawkes in the title. So if you want to Google Francis Edwards and Guy Fawkes, then you'll see some stuff.
Question.
So they essentially what the papacy has done is they don't speak directly on this. They delegate it to various Jesuit scholars who do the work for them.
If I remember history correctly, sometime after this, Parliament shut down for 35 years. Was that a consequence of the alleged Gunpowder Plot or something unrelated?
Well, I think it's a consequence of Oliver Cromwell, whose hobby was dissolving parliaments. Right? You know these things, right? These famous quotes from Cromwell saying, "You are no parliament, go with God, but go, get out of here, you're dissolved, scram, beat it."
Was that a consequence of the so-called Gunpowder Plot?
This is a little bit distant because we're going from 1605 to the 1640s and 1650s.
Yeah, yeah.
But I would like to say this: if you have a state religion that is based on this fantastic lying story, and you incorporate that into the Book of Common Prayer. I mean, to some people, you know, if you believe in religion, this is blasphemy. How can you incorporate an event like this into your Book of Common Prayer? In other words, this, you know, the words of Coke are not the word of God, right? The word of James the First or Robert Cecil cannot be the word of God. This is nuts. So what you do with this is you politicize religion to such an extent that then in the 1640s you get this backlash, which is led by Puritans, yeah, Congregationalists for sure, but then the Diggers, the Seekers, the Ranters, the Muggletonians, the Fifth Monarchists, the Grindletonians, in other words, this wild zoo of sects that came up in England in the 1640s and 1650s. The Diggers are communists, the Levellers are communists in their own way, and, you know, they all have, you know, the Ranters want free love, and you know, the alehouse is the center of religion. So what you've got is a, it seems to me, is a qualitative decay of religion when you try to incorporate these events into religion. And I think this is sort of what's going on today. If you look at the Christian fundamentalists, I think you'll probably find that they observe 9/11 as some kind of a religious apocalyptic event.
The other thing is a broad question. Maybe you can make a simple answer. Could this be an excuse why, over all the years, England never had a written organic law like the U.S. Constitution?
Yes, very good.
Common law, which was accepted from the time of Lord Coke to now, but they never wrote anything down. Is that a consequence of all this, or what?
I think it has a lot to do with it. Here, the problem that Sherman is addressing, for those who don't know, is in England there's no written constitution. We have a written constitution. They have none. And you'll say, well, where's the constitution? They say, well, it's the king, the lords, and the commons. Yeah, but what?
No. No, that's not totally true. As a Canadian, I can tell you that their constitution is very much in the oral tradition of common law and tort law.
Yeah, but
and it's oral. There's an oral constitution.
Yeah, I know, but what's an oral constitution?
Well, Americans who are visually biased will have a problem understanding that, but there's a strong,
well, let me finish my
there's
point.
A very
it's a good
strong oral constitution, because
the oral
it forms the heart of our
target.
Constitution here in Canada. Our written constitution is based on the oral constitution of the British.
Let me finish, please.
Yeah.
The English Constitution is like the Tao. It's everywhere and it's nowhere. You want to say, where is it? I want to read it. They'll say, well, it's a body of precedents that define the relation among king, lords, and commons. Fine, so at least let me see an unofficial collection of those precedents. Well, they say, you can't even have that. And the reason why is a lot of those precedents are secret precedents that you're not allowed to know. And as Sherman has pointed out, you have the Star Chamber, you have these secret courts that they have all the time. We have them here, too, in the U.S. But it will probably turn out that a lot of the relations among king, lords, and commons, when the archives are finally opened after the Revolution, that they're determined by those secret decisions back in the Star Chamber and back in the Bloody Assizes that Sherman has been talking about, so that you have a constitution which has no... It's anything you want it to be. The other thing about it is, in the English system, there's absolutely no distinction between a constitutional amendment and a statute law. In other words, as soon as you have a parliament, you have a prime minister with a majority, they can pass anything they want by majority vote, and that changes the constitution, and that's wild. There's no distinction between constitutional amendment and just the statute law that they ram through from time to time.
I'm interested in the subject because I once, years ago, wrote an appeal brief about secret courts.
Sherman, we're getting off the point. We're running off time. Let's get back to the gunpowder plot and sum it up, because we're getting close to. We got a few minutes left.
Well, I would go back. Let's see. Who can we quote? We can quote perhaps from Godfrey Goodman. Let's see if we find him. Godfrey Goodman was the Anglican Bishop of Gloucester, and he was a contemporary of these events. And his finding is, Cecil knew about Catholic resentment of James the First. And because he would show his service to the state, he first contrived and then discovered a treason. And the more odious and hateful the treason was, the more his service would be greater. and the more acceptable. So, another one, short view of English history. Some have affirmed that this design was first hammered out in the Forge of Cecil, who had originally intended to produce this plot in the time of Elizabeth. And to this end, by his secret emissaries, he enticed some hot-headed men of the Catholic persuasion who, ignorant whence the design first came, heartily engaged in this execrable treason plot. So, he acted in the double spirit of his predecessor Walsingham, and basically everybody in this plot had his role assigned by Cecil. Some were conscious double agents who thought that they were going to be spared, but they were liquidated, and a lot of them were just fanatics, dupes, and patsies. And it's a clear example of state-sponsored false flag terrorism 400 years ago.
Great stuff, Webster. Thanks so much for updating us on that. It's just tremendous to have your depth of wisdom and knowledge here to give us an update.
Yeah, absolutely. Mention your book, Webster.
Yes, that would be. Thank you, Sherman. It's 9/11 Synthetic Terror, Made in USA. You can order it through Amazon. Thank you so much. And happy Guy Fawkes Day to all.
And happy Guy Fawkes Day back to you, and we'll look forward to seeing you again on Thursday for our regular update briefing. And at that time, you can update us more about the false flag operations that we're living through now.
Stay on the line, Webster. You may like my concluding statement. But first of all, let me just put a note. For those that want to subscribe to my email list to find out how to do that.
When the legend becomes fact, print the legend.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Trusting in the sanity and restraint of the United States is not a strategy, and it is not an option.
What's a conspiracy notion out there? How much influence do you have? Was it you and your fellow neoconservatives that created the momentum towards overthrowing Saddam Hussein?
Nobody does a thing in this town without our approval.
You both were members of Skull and Bones, a secret society at Yale. What does that tell us?
Not much, because it's a secret.
Is there a secret handshake? Is there a secret code?
I wish there were something secret I could manifest.
322, a secret number?
There are all kinds of secrets.
Becomes fact, print the legend.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Trusting in the sanity and restraint of the United States is not a strategy, and it is not an option.
What's a conspiracy notion out there? How much influence do you have? Was it you and your fellow neoconservatives that created the momentum towards overthrowing Saddam Hussein?
Nobody does a thing in this town without our approval.
You both were members of Skull and Bones, a secret society at Yale. What does that tell us?
Not much, because it's a secret.
Is there a secret handshake? Is there a secret code?
I wish there were something secret I could manifest.
322, a secret number?
There are all kinds of secrets.